where it was, it started with a frustration, which is what a lot of people start with. A lot of people listen to this podcast are frustrated with whatever job they have or whatever company they're working for, even if they enjoy, maybe they're in the restoration space already and they're just frustrated with the company that they're at, or they're frustrated with their plumbing job or whatever. But a lot of times it starts there, right? It starts with this frustration that leads to, I've got to find something different and something better. And at the end of the day, you've made pivots along the way to find what is now what you would call, you know, the dream career, right? The dream life. Hey everyone, welcome back to Business Aspirin. I'm your host, Clint Janelle, a podcast where we try to help the next entrepreneur solve the problems and not butt their head against the wall. And if they do, give them a solution. And today we have with us Nick Lambert. Nick is with Faithful Restoration out of Billings, Montana. Is that right?
Yep, that's Nick. Right.
And then, but Nick, however, is in Texas, in the great state of Texas.
Yeah.
Welcome, Nick, to the great state of Texas. So,
yeah, awesome.
Welcome, my friend. How are you, brother?
Doing good. How are you?
I'm doing really well. I'm so excited to have you on. I'll be able to talk about stuff. We've got some mutual industry experience together and been through some things. So who is Nick Lambert and how the heck did you get into the restoration space, brother?
Oh man, that's a loaded question. Nick Lambert is somebody who likes to live life very fast and fun. I love to go to concerts. Love the 80s, anything about the 80s. In fact, wearing my Ghostbuster shirt.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, I do all sorts of different things in my professional life, but this is who I am. I'm a flip-flops and t-shirt guy. In the winter, you know, I wear jeans, but you'll never see me in a suit and tie. I'm just not a suit and tie guy. And so as far as I am a man who has strong faith in Christ. I try to put Christ first in everything I do. And then it's family after that. And then it's work. And so I live a life that most entrepreneurs, I would say, dream to live, because I have a business that runs for me and it allows me the freedom to do what I want to do. And so I often say, you know, I'm living a life that I don't need a vacation from. I still like to take vacations, but I'm not being a billionaire, being somebody who is filthy, stinking rich. That's not what drives me. What drives me is being able to take care of others and being able to provide for my family. So for me, life is more about, you know, the moments and sharing those moments and having time with those moments versus, you know, chasing that big ring that some people never get to and leaving behind all those people that you love. So, because when life's over and God calls you home, nobody's gonna care what you bought. Nobody's gonna care what kind of clothes you wore, what kind of car you drove, where you lived. It's gonna be the moments you made with them. So that's what's important to me. So going to how I started, how I got into the restoration business, we just celebrated our 20th year of being in business. And how I got started was, I was in a dead-end job in the restaurant industry. And I'd been there for over 6.5 years. I was a corporate trainer, server, made really good money, but I wanted something different. And my wife was pregnant. We were newly weds, probably a year and a half married, and my wife was pregnant. And I just knew that I needed to do something different with my life. My dad had been in the restaurant industry until he was probably 40 years old, and it did a number on him. And so I didn't want to be that same person. So I just decided, Clint, that, you know, when I was probably 20, I've always had an entrepreneurial spirit as I was younger, trying to figure out ways to be able to make money, going door to door, shoveling sidewalks, mowing people's house or mowing people's yards, you know, spraying their houses down, pulling weeds, whatever I could do. And so I kind of got into restoration actually as a cleaning company. I saw that my neighbor was a house cleaner. She was doing well with the company that she just started. And I thought, why not me? Why not start the same thing? So my daughter was 6 months old and my wife's like, it's never going to work. A male cleaning people's houses. And I said, that's why it's going to work, because she calls me the cleaning Nazi, because I'm like, you know, how you clean is, you know, we pick the items up, we dust around it, then we put it back down. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that my wife just really didn't think would happen, but we jumped on. She supported me. I jumped on and started a house cleaning company. And then I had customers who had stains on their carpets, and they say, go rent a rug doctor. Come and clean my carpets. I'll pay you for it. So I'd rent a rug doctor. Stains would come back over and over again. So I started researching better ways to clean carpet. Got hooked up with a local distributor, bought a little portable carpet cleaner while I was still cleaning people's houses, and started a carpet cleaning company. And then we started getting so busy with that that I bought a big truck mount unit. And at that point, I had a couple employees that cleaned houses for me, and I let them go. And I said, you guys can take the clients and clean their houses and the clientele we have that we built up, and I'm going to go do carpet cleaning. And so I started doing carpet cleaning, had restoration companies calling me and saying, hey, go suck out the water. And I kid you not, Clint, those were the terms they were using. Go suck out the water. And so I'd go and extract the water, and I'd get called back, you know, sometimes 6 months later when they were finally done putting stuff together. And I would hear from the homeowners how horrible they were with communication and how horrible they were to work with, and how they didn't do this, and they took forever. And I thought, I can do it better and I can do it faster. So I started getting into restoration. I bought, I don't know, a dozen air movers, a couple dehumidifiers, an air scrubber, a few tools. And you know, had some really great people in my in the city of Billings who kind of, you know, took me under their wing and really helped me. And they were there for those 8:30, 11 o'clock in the night calls when I'm out on a job and couldn't figure something out, and they were guiding me. So there, you know, so I really had a good mentor who never really told me he was my mentor, but he was always there when I needed him. And so started getting so busy doing restoration work and enjoyed it so much, I sold the carpet cleaning division to one of my longtime employees, and been doing disaster restoration for about 13 years. So, no, that's kind of a long question or long answer of how I got started.
It's, you know, it's,
there's a story to it. So, and I'm a story. Absolutely.
And I think it's interesting to be able to navigate that, right? Where it started with a frustration, which is what a lot of people start with. A lot of people listen to this podcast are frustrated with whatever job they have or whatever company they're working for, even if they enjoy, maybe they're in the restoration space already and they're just frustrated with the company that they're at, or they're frustrated with their plumbing job or whatever. But a lot of times it starts there, right? It starts with this frustration that leads to, I've got to find something different and something better. And at the end of the day, you've made pivots along the way to find what is now what you would call, you know, the dream career, right? The dream life. And it's afforded you the opportunity to have this company running in Billings and relocate to Texas and operate your business the way you need to from here. And that's pretty spectacular, dude.
Yeah.
Kudos to all of that.
Very, very blessed. Very blessed to be where we're at. But it wasn't an overnight success. Actually became about the time I met you, about 7 years ago or so, our company was struggling with some bad culture. And I had spent most of 2018 trying to change the culture in my business. And essentially what had happened is I gave too much control to my staff. And when I started trying to implement, hey, let's go digital, it was about the time I met you and you had Job Docs going and we're using Job Nimbus. And, you know, my staff would be like, oh yeah, we're on board. And then behind my back, they're like, yeah, he thinks we're going to go digital with this Job Dingus stuff. And, you know, just comments like that and just not being on board and dragging their feet. And so, honestly, I felt God telling me to change the culture in 2018 and I didn't listen. And so we became so slow the fall of 2018 going into January of 2019. I didn't have a choice. I had to let everybody go except for two people. So I hit the reset button on my business and decided, you know what, we're gonna get rid of everybody. I'm gonna keep two people who are like-minded with me, with cultural aspirations, and also how they view taking care of clients. They're also aligned, with me on my faith and values. And so, hit the reset button, and literally, I mean, I can tell you, it gets crazy because the month of January of 2019, I think we had $1,000 we made for the whole month. And I mean, this is just absolutely horrible. Phone's not ringing, nothing. And I brought everybody in my office one by one. I let them go, kept two people, and literally took them out to lunch and said, look, I don't know what this is going to look like, but I just got a lot of faith in God that it's going to turn around. And when it does, we're going to start hiring people for specific positions in our company instead of just hiring somebody and saying, you're wearing different hats. You're going to just do whatever we need you to do. And we're going to hire people that, you know, fit our culture and the culture we want. And literally, Clint, during that lunch, my phone started ringing with jobs and it didn't stop. And it didn't stop. We shot up from, you know, probably being a few weeks from, I wouldn't say a few weeks, but if things didn't change drastically in the next couple months, we probably were going to be out of business, or at least just down to me doing stuff. It just didn't stop. We scaled. In 3 short years, we hit 8.5 million gross. And that's in a city of 120,000 people.
Just crazy, right?
Absolutely crazy. Absolutely crazy. And we actually used to joke about it, Clint. We used to say, this is so crazy, Nick. One day I tell some of my staff, I'd say, I'm going to write a book about this one day, because the crazy things that happen, you know, you could only equate it to faith in God. And so I did. I wrote a book about it and published it earlier this year. And so I kind of gave people the story and the blueprint of how I did it. And it's really unique and really crazy, you know, what we accomplished in 3 years. And
well, so like, if it's around you, why don't you grab that book and let's show it to everybody real quick and have everybody go get that book.
Yeah, give me a second.
Where they can get it. If not, and we'll have Tyler link it whenever he does podcast side.
It's called Never Say Die. And essentially, it's 100% wrote by me. No ghostwriter. You know, no AI. This is 100% me. And so, it's got a little blurb on the back. But when we released it, we ended up number one bestseller for about a week. In our category, which was absolutely insane to be able to get that as well.
Great, dude.
Yeah, very, very blessed for that. But it's a great book. It's a fun read. I love the 80s. I love storytelling. So it's got a lot of stories in it, and it's got a lot of nostalgia. I use Rocky, the movie of Rocky, to, you know, and stories in that, and show you how I integrated things in my own company. So it's very, it's a very fun read. It's not a very boring analytical numbers, you know, if you do this, you can achieve this. It's driven in story. And I like,
where do we get that book, Nick?
You can get it on Amazon. If you search Never Say Die, Nick Lambert or Nicholas Lambert, it'll pop up. We are adding it to our website, but I think it's going to be another 2-3 months before we have it up on there.
So here's what I want to say. If you guys are listening to this podcast and you can't afford to buy Nick's book, send us a message and I will get Nick's book for you and get it shipped to you, because I think it'd be great. And I love the fact that you did that, Nick. And I know what's going to be in it just because of knowing who you are. But I want to go back, and I want to go back to the phone not ringing. And I want to go back to that call. What happened? You moved from the phone's not ringing. I got to let some people off. This is not going the way I need to. I need to change the culture. I ignored it initially, but somewhere that trigger came back again and you're like, I got to make some changes. And I want you to talk about deeper going through that process.
Yeah. Well, I mean, are you talking like how I came to the conclusion that I need to make those changes, or?
Yeah. I mean, what we're trying to do here is give people some insight into how, as entrepreneurs, we navigate the waters of business. And in your case, it's faith-based, and it's, I'm praying about this and I'm trying to listen to God tell me what direction I think I need to go. And when things aren't working that direction, or I'm ignoring, or I'm not listening, or whatever's happening, talk about the experience.
Yeah. Yeah. So really it kind of started in, you know, actually about this time in 2017, we had taken on a real large loss, a commercial large loss. And there were just some things that I was noticing with my staff, and I had made a deal with my general manager to keep him from going to another restoration company earlier in the year. And it was a deal that I want to say immediately, within a couple months of making it, regretted making it. Because here I had a guy who really didn't want to do more than 40 hours of work, a week of work. He was at times making a paycheck and I wasn't. So I started having buyer's remorse with that. And going into 2018, I noticed on job sites, there was, you know, it was very, I guess the way I would probably put it is very construction labor-esque. You know, lots of profanity, sometimes inappropriate jokes, inappropriate conversations that, you know, even inappropriate gestures. And it just got to the point where I'm just like, this is not who our company is. This is, I don't feel like this is who God wants me to be and who our identity is. And we had struggled, Clint, for years growing. We would hire people and the running joke would be, oh gosh, Nick's hiring somebody, we're going to be dead. And we would be. We'd hire somebody and then we'd be dead for 6 weeks. I mean, not like dead, but, you know, not busy by any means. And so it just felt like whenever we were trying to scale, we were hitting that ceiling and bouncing back down. And so when I started seeing stuff, I've been doing a lot of praying and just give me guidance, God, show me where I need to go. And I was just doing a lot of praying and just things started coming to my eyes, you know, of what was going on. And I spent 2018 thinking, I can change these people. I don't need to cut bait with them. I can take these people and I can make them better leaders. I can change their culture in them. But whenever I, like I said earlier, whenever I tried to do something, it would go completely backwards. I tried to implement. I mean, I remember having conversations with my GM when we left REITs when I first met you. And I'm like, damn, it's job docs. I think this could be really good for us. And he's like, that's for bigger companies and bigger cities. You know, and he had grown up in the business. So, and he was taught to do it a certain way. And so I can't be upset at him. I mean, it wasn't his fault, but I would let conversations like that guide me and sway me. And so, when I finally knew that I needed to do something, it was Christmas of 2018. I shouldn't say finally knew, but when I knew, okay, this is it, I'm going to do something. It's Christmas of 2018, probably a couple days before Christmas. Again, we are slow. The office phone we didn't have an office phone. So literally I would carry two phones. I had my personal phone and then I had a business phone. So I would hand the business phone off to them. And I was in a little mountain town about an hour away from Billings and enjoying Christmas with our family. A family cabin up there. So I'm enjoying Christmas up there a couple days before. And our Verizon had lost complete everything. Service. And I started worrying, my gosh, we're dead. Our phones aren't ringing. And I'm out of money. And I'm thinking, okay, now Verizon, we need to make sure that we transfer these phones to make sure that we get it to somebody else's phone. And so I started making calls and I'm calling like literally for my sister's phone because she's got AT&T and I'm making calls. I'm calling people in the company that I know have AT&T. Can't get a hold of anybody. Nobody's answering their phone. Finally was able to get a hold of somebody. They get me in touch with my GM and he pretty much just ripped me up one side and down the other for bugging him. And I'm like, during his lunch, and I'm like, no, this isn't how it should be. And he's even like, well, you know what? The phones aren't ringing anyway. So it isn't going to matter if Verizon isn't working or not. It's not like we're going to get any calls. And at that point, Clint, I realized, he's gone. He's checked out. And that was the point when I'm like, I need to do something. So I put a plan in motion. There's one of my employees who I trusted and he had been with me the longest. And I pulled him aside. I said, look, this is what I'm planning to do. I want you to prayerfully, think about things and how we should go forward. And we decided both of us to keep the same second person. But you want to talk about feeling like I felt like I had nowhere to go. I felt like I was on the verge of losing everything. Just like, you know, where you almost like an analogy is like, you're so close to the cliff. I didn't feel like I was that close to the cliff. I felt like I was hanging over the cliff with my hand on one branch and just waiting for the cracks to just break and me go. And to attest to that, when I cut everybody, my former manager threw a little barn party for all of our old staff and stood up there and said, yeah, Nick will be closed in 3 weeks, maybe four tops. And so I didn't know that until about a month and a half later, but that was fuel to the fire, right? It's like, I want to prove people wrong. If you don't think I'm going to make it, I'm going to show you that I can. And I even talk about this in my book, Clint. I don't blame my manager at all. I blame myself. I never should have given that much control over somebody and never should have allowed the culture that took place to take place. I should have put things in motion and practice to make sure that the culture was better. But when you have this type of culture that's so negative, when you can walk into the office and feel like you're going to have an anxiety attack because, you know, you had made a decision to do something and the GM didn't agree with it. So he goes and gets everybody to sit down around the table and, well, we don't agree with that. Well, I'm sorry you don't agree with that, but I'm the business owner and that's what we're going to do. Well, I don't agree with it. And Darren, what about you? Well, I don't. And goes around the table and each person says their thing. And this was an orchestrated meeting by him. And this was right after that Christmas episode. And so in my mind, I'm like, why am I even arguing? I know what's coming. I was just waiting to get to a certain date to make everything happen. And I didn't want to be that guy that, okay, it's the 3rd of January. I'm going to cut everybody. New year, new jobs, you know. I wear my heart on my sleeve. And sometimes I take a little bit more than I should. And I don't want to say I'm too forgiving because I'm called to be to forgive, right? But I think that I allow myself, or at least used to allow myself, to get walked on in situations like that. So, but when I'm sitting around this table having these conversations, I'm just like, you know what? This is not going anywhere. And I'm arguing with them. And I even said, well, if that's the way it needs to be, I said, then you can leave. There's the door. And he kind of backpedaled, well, I'm not, you know, and then he's like, I just, what you want to do, the company's not ready to do yet. And knowing in my heart what I was already going to do, I was like, okay, sounds good. I'll just go along with you. And then 3 weeks later, we hit the reset button. But when you talk about bringing people into your office and having to let them go, it's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. The hardest thing I've ever done. I don't know if I can still say it's the hardest thing I've ever done, but it's probably one of the hardest moments I've ever had to overcome. Or yeah, difficult.
Especially one by one, bringing them in and letting them all go at the same time, right? That's a rough experience for sure.
At the time, it's not like we had 40 employees. We had like, I don't know, 8 or 9 employees. So it wasn't like it was an all-day thing, but, you know, one by one, people coming out of my office and it was like, I was just like, go. And then so everybody's like, oh my gosh, you know. But it had to be done, you know. And in the eyes of those people, I'm an asshole. I'm a jerk, you know. At the same time, it's like, look, I did what I had to do. I did what I like God was calling me to do. Judge me how you will, but at the end of the day, I did what I needed to do to survive.
I don't disagree with that. I think that's the right call, and it's obviously paid off and has been a blessing for you and some other families and maybe even some of those people again or other employees as a result, right?
Oh, for
sure. So let's talk about how you navigated. You got a chance to do the reset button and you got a chance to start over. How did you navigate that process of building the culture again, or this time actually just building a culture, right? Because before, I don't know if you would agree with this or not, but what I'm hearing is you didn't establish the culture to start with and you let it just kind of be what it was. And then whoever came in influenced the culture and changed the culture. And the next person came in and they, you know, modified the culture because of who they were. So let's talk about because I think culture is vitally important. And I think there's a lot of unique steps that can go into that. And I just want to hear, how did you establish a culture to align it with your worldview, to align it with what your philosophy on business is and all those things?
Yeah. I wanted a culture where people felt valued. I wanted a culture where I felt valued. I wanted a culture where our staff would, I apologize, they're mowing right next to my window. I'm like, just finish up, you're done, go away. All right, let me get back to that again. I wanted a culture that people were going to thrive in. I wanted a culture where people came in the doors and they felt valued, they felt loved. And I wanted that to be reciprocated to our clients. I wanted our clients to feel that way. And at times I didn't feel like our clients did feel that way. Plus, I call it the old regime, but with the old regime, I was working 70, 80 hours a week sometimes while everybody else was working 40 hours. And there were times I wasn't even getting a paycheck because I was keeping everybody else paid and, you know, I'm not making any money. So I wanted a culture that I could build a business that would take care of me and I didn't necessarily have to be fully present for it. And so I had a conversation with my wife and I remember we were actually in San Antonio And I waited until we got back from San Antonio to hit the reset button. But my sister lives in San Antonio. So we went down and we'd already had this trip planned for like over a year. Tickets were paid for, all this other stuff. Or else I probably couldn't afford to go. But we have this trip planned. We go and we have this trip. And on the way back, I remember telling my wife, I said, you know, Jen, this next year is going to suck. It's going to suck. There's going to be a lot of late nights. There's going to be a lot of me not. I'll try to be there as much as I can for everything that I can. But I said, but what I promise you is if it works how I think it's going to work, it's going to free me up to be able to really do what I want to do. You know, I didn't have the vision at the time of saying live a life that, you know, I can only dream of or live a life that you don't need a vacation from. I didn't have that. But so it just, that was kind of the mindset is I want a new culture. So the phone didn't stop ringing. It literally kept ringing after I hit the reset button, and a big snowstorm hit in maybe about 2 weeks later. And I'm talking cold temperatures, the dream situation for a restorer, cold temperatures and a lot of snow. And when I mean cold, I'm talking below freezing for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. So we were slammed. We were busy. We couldn't keep up with it all. And so I thought, okay, I need to hire somebody. And so I decided that I was going to hire somebody that I could have take personality tests. So we started implementing personality tests to see how they mesh. And I wasn't even sure of exactly what I wanted the culture to or how it was going to be, but I wanted a place, again, where people felt valued. And I knew I needed a change as a leader as well, and making sure that I, you know, led them through this battle, but also created new leaders at the same time. So we hired one guy. We were having a conversation, me and one of my staff members, and I said, you remember that job we did from that guy named Wes? And they're like, yeah, he was a younger guy. And I said, you remember how he was asking all these questions? He's very inquisitive about stuff, very interested in the science and everything of our business. Yeah. I said, I want staff members like that. And then I thought, why don't I reach out and see if Wes wants a job? A week and a half later, Wes was working for us. and he was with us for quite a few years before he went on to do other things that he had aspirations to do. But, you know, but we started finding people that had values, same values of us, not necessarily people that were people of faith. I mean, you know, really that's against the law. You can't hire just based off of, you know, people's religion. But we looked for people who are aligned in values, taking care of people. We looked for people on our DISC assessments that if we wanted a certain position that required more of a servant leader, we wanted to make sure that they were an S. If we needed somebody who was, you know, we wanted them to be more of a leader, we wanted to make sure that they had more of a, you know, idea or an I in them with an S. And so we started kind of developing, okay, the next position we're going to hire for this, it's going to be an office position. And we started interviewing people that we thought would make good office personnel. And once we found it, we wanted somebody that understood computers and understood systems. And that was Gilbert. And Gilbert actually had come to me about a year and a half before when his wife and I grew up together. So we knew each other. And he had come to me about a year and a half before. And I had told, you know, we'd set up an interview, but the culture wasn't good at that time. It was early 2018. And he blew off the interview, like didn't even show up. And so I'm like, well, whatever. So then about a year and a half later, you know, when his wife reaches out and like, hey, do you have anything for Gilbert? I'm like, no, he blew me off on this interview. Why would I ever give him a chance? But then she's like, we keep praying and Faithful keeps coming to my mind. And I'm like, okay, God wants me to talk to this person. So I brought him in for an interview and realized that this was a guy that understood IT, understood systems and processes. And so I'm like, I'm going to hire you and you're going to be my guy that helps me build systems and processes. And that was a very influential hire. And while we're doing this, we start to develop a chemistry as a team, right? We celebrate the wins. Hey, we just finished this job. It's 3:30 in the afternoon. At the time, I think there were six of us. I'm like, let's go to the sports bar. Let's call it a day early. Let's go get some wings and tacos and start watching some games, you know? And so we would do that. And just starting to create that family atmosphere. We started, you know, having a Faithful of the Month and Faithful of the Week. We started bringing people, doing stuff as a group after hours, you know. There's a wrestling event coming to town. Anybody want to go to WWE? Yeah. Well, Faithful will buy the tickets. you and your family want to go. So we started doing stuff like that and making it feel like a true family. And what I found is that by reinvesting, and I'm also reinvesting in my staff at the same time, you know, getting them the proper training that they need, building them up, being a leader that was a coaching leader, and not tearing people down when they screwed up, but saying, look, you did, this is wrong. This is why it's wrong. This is how we do it, but here's why we do it. Because it's important that you understand the why of it. Because if you understand the why, you're less likely to ever make that. So really, it was a whole investment in people. And as we kind of continued to hire, we started to see what this culture was becoming and gravitated to that. It was that culture where people felt valued. It was a culture where people felt like we were a family. And so as we started to do it, I'm like, I want more of this. So we'd go do camping trips together. We'd bring the boat out and fish together, you know, during these camping trips. And
how big were you at this time, Nick? How many people when you're doing these types of
things? When we started doing the camping trips, there were probably 7, 8, maybe. I could say 6, 7. My kids seem to love that combination, 6, 7. Now, I think we were like 7 or 8 people at the time. But here's the thing is we grew. We doubled down on our culture. As we grew, we put way more into the culture to make sure that we succeeded. Well,
and at that point, too, the team is also demanding the culture be what the culture is, right? If somebody shows up and you put the wrong person on the seat, they ran them off quickly, probably.
Well,
if that were happening. Because, like, we try to be transparent. Like, when I interview anybody here for Mr. Restore, we don't do a ton on the job doc side to interview. But if I hire somebody here at Mr. Restore, when they come in for an interview, I'm very clear about who we are. Like, you see the American flag behind me? This is who I am. Do you see these things? Like, you should notice this. If you come in with purple hair, you're probably going to hate it here because you probably don't align with us. And I mean, some people, I've got really good friends that are crazy conservative to a, like, just gnarly with purple hair. But for the most part, it's like, there's no reason for us to start this process if you're going to be miserable and we're going to be miserable.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So let's make sure we're aligned on what we're doing here. I mean, all the Mr. Restore shirts have an American flag on the shoulder. We've got stuff up in the front that, you know, we've got a cross that's made out of parts of fire hose in the front, right? Like, there's just different things that we kind of point to. This is who we are. And we want to be transparent about that because, no, I can't ask you about certain things in an interview. I can tell you 100% who I am.
Yep.
And then if that bothers you, then, you know, and things aren't perfect. Like, I've got people here that don't believe the same faith thing that I believe.
Same.
I've got people here that would state that they believe the same thing that I believe, and they don't believe the same thing I believe. And, you know, but for the most part, everybody's aligned culturally into who we are and what we do. That makes a huge difference, dude.
For sure. People
are willing to get up and go to work. I mean, you can be here and you know somebody's going to go respond to whatever emergency that comes in at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Yep.
And I don't have to be the one doing it. That's.
I spent 15, more than 15 years doing that. You know, I put my time into that. But no, you hit it right on the button. I mean, when it comes to hiring people, like you said, you can't tell them, you know, you can't ask who they. You can't ask certain aspects, but you can tell them who you are. And there were times when we would hire somebody and we hired a younger kid. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us, not with the company, but he's passed on. He had a tragic motorcycle accident a couple of years ago, but good kid from my church, but just kind of sarcastic clown, you know, clowning. And it was funny because we were sitting around the table one morning and I came in and before our morning meeting. And I remember Jeremy saying, oh, just wait till Wes gets here. And you think you just wait. And man, it didn't take Wes long to, you know, you're not the guy, ran him off. But it wasn't so much running him off. It was just like, you're not meshing with our tribe. And it wasn't a click. It wasn't a click atmosphere, but they saw before even I saw that this guy wasn't going to be a good fit. They saw it. And so, yeah. And that was that mentality is, you know, but the thing that did, you know, the thing that kind of became counterintuitive is we tried to grow and we did get bigger. I mean, at our peak, we had 40 people. And so as we grew, that longing to be smaller from a lot of people was there. well, it's not the same as it used to be. And it's like, well, it's hard to be the same. I've got 40 different personalities. You're not going to mesh with everybody anymore. You're not going to all have the same views. You're not going to all like to do the same things. And so we still did a lot of things and had a lot of fun and did a lot of really cool, you know, team things together. But that longing was always there to, I miss being smaller. I miss being, you know, we were better when we were smaller. We did this when we were smaller. And so, and we did make the decision about 2 years ago that we wanted to go in a different direction. And so we actually got rid of the repair division that we had, which eliminated about half of my positions in the company. But because we had drywallers on staff, painters on staff, but being a restorer, you know how challenging it can be to get estimates approved with the insurance company, especially on the repair side. And it might be different here in Dallas, but in Montana, you don't have hundreds of drywallers to choose from. You have a handful. And so if they're telling you it's going to be $4,000 and the next guy's telling you it's going to be $4,000 and the other guy's telling you it's going to be $4,000, it's going to be $4,000. And if the insurance says I'm only paying $2,000, well, it's not coming out of my pocket. And so we weren't profiting. It was costing us and it was causing more headaches and what wasn't allowing us to have the same service. So we made the decision that we want to be smaller and go back to that a little bit smaller mentality. And quite honestly, it's actually benefited us quite well. I never wanted to be the biggest. I just wanted to be the best. We just grew to be the biggest and then realized, you know what? Our profit margins weren't as good. Our headaches were a lot more. You know, at the end of the day, I just don't feel like our service was where it
And those are hard days, and it's hard to reconcile that in your head, right? And then continue to push through it where you're like, okay, I'm working harder than I have. We're doing more than we've done. I'm not making any money. The company's not making any more money. I'm like, why do we continue down this path, right? Let's figure out a way to pivot. And kudos to you for that, right? I think that's a valuable lesson to a lot of people too, is because some people are just going to be like, I'm just going to keep grinding all the way to nothing. And wearing themselves out in the process because they're unwilling to, because so many people consider that failure. And you and I look at that and go, no, that's success. I was willing to make the pivot the right direction to save my sanity and save the profitability of my company so that we can continue to thrive.
Yeah. I don't make those changes. Faithful probably wouldn't be here still. I think we would have eventually ran out of cash and not been able to operate. I mean, when you have a big monster like that, when you do $8.5 million gross annually, you're not making $8.5 million.
No.
You do repairs, there's a lot of that goes back out to repairs. And so you can only imagine what that monthly overhead was like. When you're talking $500,000 a month in overhead, that's a lot. Oh, that's a lot. And it's not that that's what it was costing me to keep all this staff. But, you know, if I want good drywallers who actually have, you know, experience, I've got to pay for them.
Yeah, sure
and
you do.
You have a fleet of 30 vehicles and you have gas, you have insurance. And then you, Mrs. Smith, you get 50% down, but after COVID, everything changed. We went from being able to have accounts with the flooring and the cabinetry where we would just say, okay, yeah, our clients would go, they'd pick out what they want and then they would order it. And then when they came in, we'd get an invoice. It wasn't like that anymore. It changed. COVID changed everything like that. So 100% down for cabinets. And then you'd pay the install after it was in. And we're like, so the insurance doesn't give me 100% up front. And so what we were doing is we were putting our profit on the repair until the job was done. Well, if you're ordering cabinets post-COVID, sometimes it was 4 to 6 months. And that there was nothing we could do. That was 4 to 6 months. And so you're talking in, you know, 2021, waiting 6 months to get cabinets in, and you fronted $80,000 worth of expenses on this house, and your profit is, maybe it's a $100,000 job, and your profit's sitting at 30%, and you have at this point fronted, you know, $60,000 on the job, and you've gotten $20,000 from the insurance, or maybe $30,000. The numbers don't.
Yeah, you're banking all that now. And it's just a tough, tough way to make that work for sure. So listening to you, I would say that you would contend that having the right culture is probably the most important decision you made.
The right culture and right leadership. Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely. So then what's the single biggest suggestion that you would give to somebody in regard to hiring for culture?
Hire people that I always look to try to find somebody who's just like me, right? As far as with the energy, with what they bring with attitude, with what they bring with values. I would throw faith into that too, but you know, again, you can't, but you try, right? And when you start to create a culture that is fun and inviting, you know what happens? People walk into your building and they're like, I love it in here. I feel at peace in here. Are you guys hiring? You know what? We are. What's your experience? I've got great computer experience. And all of a sudden, you're bringing those people in for an interview. So making sure that the biggest thing with culture is making sure that they align with your values. If you don't have a mission statement, you don't have a vision statement, and you don't have values already, you know, figured out for your company, you really need to get those done, because until you get those done, you're not really going to be able to show or tell other people what your company stands for. Yeah, the name of my company is Faithful. Yeah, you may be like, oh, well, then you obviously have a lot of faith. Well, yeah, I have a lot of faith, but that doesn't tell you why we exist. It doesn't tell you who we are. It doesn't tell you the values that we have. And so making sure that you have somebody who's lined up with your values, and somebody who's going to fit our culture is also going to be somebody who's not afraid to jump in and do whatever they are asked to do when they are asked to do it. Somebody that wants a career path. If you're looking for, we hire people that want to want to make changes in their own lives, make changes in other people's lives by, you know, serving. And so I guess that's probably the number one thing I would look for, Clint. Somebody who is a servant.
Servant-hearted.
And honestly, in our industry, in the service-based industry, it says it. Service. Servant. Service. You're going to get your best return from people who are servant-based, who are servant-hearted. And I'm not talking like, well, I'm Mother Teresa, I'm going to go and serve. Not like that. I'm talking that are not afraid to be real with people. I've sat on curbs and cried with people while their house is burning down and hugged them while they just lost a loved one. You got to be empathetic in this business. You've got to be able to serve. You have to be able to do whatever is necessary. So in our industry, I look for somebody who's servant-hearted. And I think that when you find people who serve, they're going to fit your culture a lot better, because they're not in it just for themselves. They're in it for what they can get out of it too, and what they can put into it and get back.
So if you're an entrepreneur, a brand new entrepreneur, would you establish your mission, vision, and culture before you started? If you could, if you haven't started already, if you have started already, you got to make that decision. But would you do that before, or would you hire your first employee? Which one would you do first?
That's a tough question. I can tell you what I didn't do. I never did that first. I just started and then I hired employees, right? But I would tell people now, you need to know why you exist. You need to come up with a mission statement. You need to come up with a vision. And maybe it's like, well, I'm starting a roofing company, which I'm not, but I'm starting a roofing company down here. So maybe it's, I'm starting a roofing company. Why do I exist? Well, I want to be able to help people repair their homes, make sure that they have a safe home. What's my vision? Maybe my vision is based off of being local and serving locally. Maybe I have a vision to eventually expand and grow all over the United States. But you can change your vision. You can change your mission as you go. You can change your values as you go. Because when we hit the reset button, we took the old mission, we took everything, and we scrapped it. And we said, we're starting, we're doing it again, and we're going deeper. And we did. And I don't think there's anything wrong with reevaluating your vision, mission, and values every 5-6 years, because
you change who you are. You change the trajectory of your company. Things are going to change.
Environments change around you. The world changes around you.
COVID's a perfect example of that, right? Now, how do we pivot around that? Insurance companies changing deductibles change what you have the opportunity to do. So you've got to navigate who you are and what you're about and what you're... Now, I don't think who you are changes. You're still the same person that is now changing the direction of your company based off those things, but your goal is still, for you, is still faith-based, servant-hearted, you know, moving the right direction to help others and honor God in the process, right? And so I think that's great. Brother, I've taken a lot of your time today, so I want to quickly wrap up a couple things.
Yeah, no problem.
Is there anything in the process that just shocked you, that just blindsided you, you didn't expect?
Yes, we grew too fast. And at the time, we didn't realize it. But when we finally did realize it, that was when we made decisions to navigate. And, you know, we talk about you can't go back and you can't change things, right? And I can sit here and say, well, knowing what I know now, I would have not done that. And I would have done this instead. And I could have done that. And I would, woulda, shoulda, coulda, you can't. I often talk about the rearview mirror is so small when you're driving. And that's looking back on everything in your past. When you have this windshield that's so huge in front of you, you got to stay focused on the windshield and stay focused on what's in front of you. And what I would say is that knowing what I know now, I would have slowed our growth. Because when we grew too fast, what happened, especially when you're busting at the seams, you start saying yes to jobs that you normally would not say yes to, just because it takes so much money. And it's not because Nick needs money. It takes so much money to run this business.
Yeah.
You got to have fuel to keep that engine going and to keep firing on all cylinders. And so we said yes sometimes, and we said this, should have said no. And it bit us in the butt. And there were times where we would get, you know, I mean, and rightfully so, we'd get blown away on, you know, like a Facebook customer service watchdog page or something because of something that one of my staff members didn't handle properly. But all in all, our customer service still stayed very, very high. But knowing what I know now, I would have capped it. I would have said, you know what? I'm comfortable growing to this level here. And now let's take some resources and let's go open another branch and serve another city that's close by. That way we can circle the territory, right? If I'm in Billings and let's say I opened one out east, well, then I can get eastern Montana and then maybe part of North Dakota and maybe part of South Dakota because I have a branch out there. You know, so those are things that, you know, knowing what I know now, it blindsided me how quickly we grew. I mean, to go from, you know, normally doing $2.5 million a year to going, I think 2020 we did 4.5, 2021 we did like 6, and then it was like 8.5. It was too fast. And when you're trying to hire infrastructure for that and train and do all that at the same time, and you're building a new building because you're out of room, it's just a lot. It's a lot to take on. So yeah, growth blindsided me. I wasn't prepared for it. And we kind of, at the time, we kind of were flying by the seat of our pants. And so, which I think was also why we were like, you know what? We made more money when it was smaller. And it's not all about the money, Clint, but we were able to take better care of people when we were smaller. We were able to give back to the community in ways that we haven't been able to, you know, now. And so now that we are back to being smaller, we're doing things like that again, where we're able to, you know, really dive in and serve our community like never before, where we just weren't able to do that as much when we were big.
Yeah. And that's great, man. I love that. And it's hard to pivot back, right? Sometimes you've bought the golden airplane and now you got to feed the golden airplane, and it's hard to get away from that, you know, but kudos to being able to make the pivot. Like I'm telling you, I think that's brilliant business. A lot of the people listen to this podcast would be like, wait a minute, what? Like, you're doing 8.5. Yeah, I was doing 8.5 and I was losing money. And now I'm doing 5 and I'm making 2 yeah. million in EBITDA, right? That's a different story. And people just don't navigate that correctly in their head because they only see revenue, and it's a different problem.
We were making money at 8.5. The repair division wasn't. I mean, some months it would, other months it wouldn't. But the mitigation was making money. But the problem is that your percentages were so much smaller. And so you had less room to be able to work with adjusters, and you had to draw the line sometimes and say, I can't do
that. And it takes forever. And that's the only place where people get frustrated with the restoration companies, on the reconstruction side.
Yep.
Right.
So we got rid of our biggest headache. I mean, look, I love being able to help people, but it's an unfair industry for restorers, in my opinion, because if a homeowner hires a plumber directly, and let's say the plumber charged $600 to fix something and they have the proper coverage, the insurance pays that plumber the $600, right? They don't usually negotiate with the insurance. If I go and I do mitigation emergency services and it's $5,000 for a dryout, And the insurance tells me, well, I'm only going to give you three. Well, how's that fair? You're going to pay the plumber what they want? Well, here's the crazy thing, the absolute craziest thing. We would be bidding jobs in Xactimate. We were about 11% higher in Xactimate than most of the other people. And for those out there, if you're not familiar with Xactimate, it's a pricing module tool that the insurance companies use to be able to gauge what is fair for a certain area of the United States at a given time in the year. And it's very, very low. That's a whole nother podcast. But I want to touch on this because I think it's important. We would bid, right? We put a bid together for like $15,000. That includes the flooring, everything like that. And that's an Xactimate. And the adjuster would be like, well, I can only approve 10. And I'm like, we can't do that. Well, meet me in the middle. I can't even meet you in the middle because at a 30% repair margin, I'm making $500 and I'm taking on all the responsibility, all the liability. And so what we started seeing happening is we started just, if we couldn't get it approved, we would just say, look, we can't get it approved. I'm sorry, Mrs. Smith, you're going to have to find another company. Well, they go and they hire a normal contractor. Mrs. Smith, I don't work with insurance. Here's my invoice or estimate. It's going to be $15,500 to do the job approved by the adjuster. Why? Because they're not restorers and they know they don't have that negotiation. And they know that Mrs. Smith is now needing to find somebody. And so I can tell you stories over and over where those type of things happen with our company. And I'm like, how is that even fair? You know? So again, it's just, it made a lot of sense. And I think you mentioned deductibles. I think in Montana, we're a little bit ahead of what a lot of the country is starting to see now. I do consulting now. I do it on a part-time basis because I don't want to do it full-time. And I'm very particular about what I consult in and who I consult with. But I do consulting, and what I'm seeing with some of my clients is stuff that we started seeing in Montana 2 years ago. Percentile deductibles, higher deductibles. You have more than one claim, they're dropping you. Certain insurance companies are pulling out. And I think that why we saw it first is Montana, especially Billings, in the last decade has been hit with so many hailstorms. And I'm not knocking roofing companies, but when every time somebody gets a little bit of hail, they think they need a new roof. And that's not always the case. And so when you get every time you need hail, oh, we got hail, I need to go and get a new roof. And we want to feel good. It feels good to get something new on the house. And it feels good to tell our neighbor, hey, Joe, check it out. I got a new roof that the insurance paid for. It feels good, right? But the problem with that is it got these insurance companies where they were paying out so much in these areas that they said, well, guess what? Billings, 1%, 2% deductibles. And I'm not talking wind hail. I'm talking mid across the board. So now, you know, you have a $7,000 water loss and the average home is like $450 in Billings. So they have a 2% deductible.
Yeah. Yeah. You're $9,000.
And the average American does not have $9,000 in savings to pay for that.
That's right. Well, that's what we say about here in DFW is a decade ago, a $300,000 house a decade ago is now a $600,000 house in DFW. And in some cases, deductibles have gone to 3%. I mean, mostly for hail roof stuff, but right. Still, you know, so people are now pivoting going, wait, the only thing they perceive wet is their carpet, right? Or their tile, and they can wipe up the tile. So they don't care about the tile, and they can, you know, get a rug doctor and suck up the water out of the carpet and put a couple fans on it. It'd be good. Right. And they just don't see the reality of what they're doing to themselves. And it's going to be we're going to have a resurgence of a mold industry because of this deductible change. I think
we're already seeing it.
Are you?
We're in it. Yeah. Our mold calls have gone through the roof, and a lot of them are people who have tried doing it themselves, you know, and people go on and they try to watch, you know, YouTube to try to figure out how to treat the mold and stuff like that. But when it comes down to it, a lot of people don't realize that it's not just about pulling the drywall out that's moldy. It's about making sure that you're doing it right, so you're not causing exposure to the rest of the home, you know? And so, yeah, we're already seeing it. And
yeah, people just don't know, right? They're just ignorant.
Unfortunately. Ignorant.
What is the single greatest piece of advice you give to somebody that's trying to become an entrepreneur or trying to get started or trying to, you know, crest past that $1 million mark? What would you share with them?
First and foremost, I have faith in God. And I believe that a lot of our success is driven based off of my faith. And trusting God and providing to provide things and also giving generously. And so I would tell them, don't be in it for the money, be in it for the right reasons. Look, we're all entrepreneurs, and that's the end goal, right? We want to be able to have a nice lifestyle. We want to be able to really have a life where we enjoy and we live like nobody else. You can't take the money with you when you die. Now, I'm not saying live broke, right? That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is be generous. Be generous to your staff. Be generous to those around you. Be generous to your community. You can't outgive God. And I truly believe that. And I believe that generosity comes back tenfold. It really does. So my biggest thing, my biggest piece of advice, be generous. Be generous with your time. Be generous with your resources. Be generous to others. It comes back. You can't outgive. You can't. You really can't. You know, and there used to be a saying, you know, with business networking back in the day, you know, givers gain. But I really believe that. Givers do gain. And of course, yeah, you can be a shark and you can be cutthroat. And I hear a lot of people, well, I'm not in business to make friends. Okay, good for you. But what do you want your legacy to be? Do you want to be that guy that, yeah, well, I made millions and millions of dollars, but nobody liked me and I died with a rich bank account? I'd rather have a very comfortable lifestyle and know that I've changed the trajectory of so many people in my life that have crossed my path.
Yeah, bro.
So being absolutely generous. Be generous.
Awesome.
And make sure you're in it for the right reasons, because
yeah, for sure.
If you're not, you're going to burn out. Entrepreneurship is not for the faint of heart.
It is not an easy task. It seems like a great idea until you're doing it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then you're like, man, what was I doing again? What was I doing? Yeah. But, you know, but I've got my hands in 3-4 different things, you know, other businesses that I'm involved with. And as you become an entrepreneur and you find success, you start looking, how can I be impactful in other ways? How can I lend my time? How can I give my resources? What else can I do? And so that's the fun part of being an entrepreneur is, you know, when you can start doing multiple things and have the freedom to be a part of multiple things.
So great. Nick, brother, man, I am grateful to have you on.
Yeah, I'm absolutely.
Grateful for the friendship. Grateful to have you as a client.
Yes.
I'm grateful that you're local now, dude. We need to
grab lunch. Absolutely. We need to get together. Yeah. Go get some lunch or something for sure.
And then we'll circle back to the part 2 podcast where we talk about overhead and profit and we talk about Xactimate pricing and all the things that we'll get yelled at for.
We might get it. That might be a 2-hour conversation.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's it's just such a misunderstood word, profit.
It is. You know?
It is. It really is.
Yeah. We'll circle back to that one.
We will definitely do that.
Thanks for being on, brother. I appreciate you.
Thanks, Clint.
Take care.